Thank you very much indeed, Subhadramati. It wasn't too embarrassing, and it hasn't set me up too much. But dear brothers and sisters, Priyabhai, Obeno, and all our Dhamma brothers and Dhamma sisters all over the world who are, I hope, with us right now. I'm very pleased indeed that I've been asked to address you on this particular occasion. And I'm very grateful to the chairs of the London centres to have given me this opportunity. I'm a little humbled by it, because it's rather an important one, if you see what I mean. It's a big talk, a big occasion for a talk. So I'm very grateful to you for having that confidence in me, assuming you did. I'm sure you did. It's an interesting anniversary, a 50th anniversary, because there are still people alive who were around in the earliest days. I myself first came along in 1969, so when I came along, the movement was already hundreds of years old, as far as I was concerned. That's the way it seemed to me. But actually, it was only 2 years old. So I've been around for 48 years in Tri Ratna. And I do remember the early centre and the early origins of the movement, although I wasn't around when the actual event took place. The event was, have we ascertained the date? The 6th of April 1967. Remember 1967? In a basement in central London near Seven Dials, Monmouth Street. It's a centre of the rag trade. It was in Victorian times. There's an interesting sketch by Boz of Monmouth Street. But now it's a rather more upmarket centre of the rag trade. And 14 Monmouth Street, I believe now, is a dress shop. At that time, it was a tiny little shop. It was a Zen shop, which of course meant it didn't sell anything. At the back, there was a winding staircase, quite narrow, very narrow. And I remember there was a footprint on the ceiling with a swastika on it, which was a bit problematic. It was the other way around, but I didn't know that at the time. And right down in the basement, about the size of the cloakroom here, was a shrine room. And the other side, about half that size, a small reception room, and somewhere down the back there, a toilet and a little kitchenette sort of thing. That was it. And when I first went along, I think there were probably 20 people there. It was really crowded. The Sangharakshita there in all his majesty, exactly the same as he is today. It's extraordinary. I saw him just a couple of weeks ago. And although he's 91, pushing 92, he's exactly the same as when I first remember him. The same quality of depth and mindfulness and presence and ironic wit and sharp clarity and very great interest in engaging with people. Just the same. Of course, he hasn't got the same energy, and he can manage for 45 minutes and then he has to have a rest. In those days, he was just absolutely indefatigable. So I go back to those days. I don't go back right to the origins, but there are a few around. Actually, none of those who are around in that earlier period. The next earliest I can see is Devamitra. It was a couple of years later, I think. Dhammadina, who you all know, Mangala, they were both around at that time. I came before them, those few important weeks. You still know people from those earliest periods, and you know people from the years that come after, the decades that come after. So when we talk about the 50th anniversary, we're talking about near history, almost not history, more like personal memory. When in another 50 years' time you celebrate the 100th anniversary, I'll be here, I think, in the creche. So you'll notice me immediately. I'll be trying to take charge. You'll know immediately. But I'm sure I won't be around in this particular incarnation at that time. But, you know, many of you may be, particularly the younger ones, you may be. But it'd be a very different experience. You'll know people who were around, who knew people who were around in those earliest days, but you will not yourself have any direct acquaintance with them. And so I have a very different relationship to the early days. The 100th anniversary is bound to be somewhat mythic, as it were. The early period is bound to be, in the lost in the mist of history and only drawn in bold outline. But you know the stories. You've met the people who are behind those stories. You have a much more intimate acquaintance with the earlier 50 years. So I think a 50th anniversary requires a different kind of reflection than later anniversaries are bound to do. Good heavens, at the 1,000th anniversary, I can't imagine what that will be like. I'm sure it'll come. And no doubt some of us will be back for the whatever time. I'm still trying to get ordained or whatever. I didn't mean to make all these gestures. Keep yourself under control. But yes, yeah, so this 50th anniversary requires a different sort of relationship to the past. And I suppose, particularly topically, we're hearing some of the darker sides of the earlier period and the more unfortunate experiences that people had. So we need to have a relationship to them that is honest, truthful, and constructive, creative. So it occurred to me that the first thing we need to do, first thing I need to do, and I suggest, dear brothers and sisters, the first thing that all of you need to do is forgive. I think that's the only way we can relate to a difficult past, and that is bound to be a difficult past, because we're human beings. We're human beings who do not know ourselves especially well, who are trying to discover ourselves, and who are coming into a closer and more deep relationship with each other. So forgiveness, I think, is of the essence of a 50th anniversary. We need to forgive those who've caused us any harm. We need to forgive those who've caused harm which has indirectly affected us, and we need to ask for forgiveness. And it's very, very striking that on the 30th of December, our teacher and founder, Urgyen Sangharakshita, issued a personal statement in which he asked us for forgiveness. And I think that's very significant. He's saying that the time has come, when we come to the 50th anniversary, we need to rededicate ourselves to the three jewels. And then he goes on to say, in that context, about his own personality and how that's affected the movement. But he then asks for forgiveness, which is an extraordinary thing to do. And one that I think we need to take very seriously. We need to think, can we forgive him? If I've no reason to forgive him personally, he's not harmed me in any way, but there are those who feel he has, whether directly or indirectly. So we need to think, can we forgive him? But we need to think about all the people who've harmed us over the years, whether, as I say, directly or indirectly, and see whether we can forgive them. And we need to ask for forgiveness ourselves. In a way, we even need to forgive ourselves. Forgiveness is a vital element in Dhamma life. I think forgiveness strikes very, very deep into the Dhamma. When you forgive, you relinquish a natural human reaction. When, clinging to self, when somebody offends you in one way or another, transgresses against you in one way or another, the natural instinctual response is of resentment, of anger, even of revenge. It's built in. It's an animal instinct, you could say, that when we become self-conscious, becomes, as it were, manipulative and amplified. So the holding of grudge, the feeling that we've been harmed and blame to others for doing so, is a natural human response. We cannot be, as it were, immediately blamed for it. It's just built into us. You know, I've seen dogs, for instance, holding grudges, if you see what I mean. They take in the threat that's come to them and they hold on to it, and then they bark at something else usually, which is what we often do. So it's completely understandable, completely natural. Every one of us, if we're honest, but of course we're honest. When we introspect, we'll see that we hold feelings of resentment or grudge to a greater or lesser extent. I've had a very privileged life, so I haven't tended to do that. I haven't suffered much in my early life. But even then, I've held on to a grudge or two, long past its sell-by date. But it's completely part of clinging to self, of having an idea of yourself as something special and unique that should be, the world should go its way, the world should support it, the world should not thwart it. Completely natural. So when you decide that you are going to forgive, it's to that extent a transcendent act. In the act of forgiveness, you give up your self-clinging to a little extent. You just let it go to a little extent. And I've myself experienced it being a very big thing when I have let go of a deep resentment, when somebody, objectively speaking, had genuinely harmed me, had acted in a way that caused me a lot of problems. And I remember, it was actually on a solitary retreat, I carried this grudge into the solitary retreat. And it's Robbie Burns, isn't it? Nursed his grudge to keep it warm. I definitely nursed it. This is for Subhadramati. I'd nursed my grudge to keep it warm. And not only had I nursed it to keep it warm, but I'd actually helped it to grow. I'd worked on it, and I'd added things that he'd done that the poor fellow hadn't even thought about doing. I'm sure he would if he thought about it. And I found myself resenting things that I'd only imagined that he might do. I'm not unique, I'm pleased to say it. And eventually I just realised, I've got to let this go. And I sort of reached down deep into myself, and it's difficult to say precisely how, I just let it go, and it did stay gone. I remember the feeling of intense release and freedom as I let it go. I felt suddenly the skies open, the sun come out, outlines become sharper and clearer, a beauty enter my world. So if we can forgive, we transcend ourselves to that extent. Actually, forgiveness goes even deeper. It goes to the depths of reality itself. It goes to the point where we are incapable of being offended. We get to the point where nothing can touch us because we've let go of anything that can be touched. This is one of the ways in which you can interpret that mythic story of the attack of Mara on the Buddha under the tree at Bodh Gaya. I interpreted it another way the other day. It's related. Where the Buddha takes the arrows that Mara fires at him and turns them into flowers. Or he doesn't turn them into flowers. It's just when they come into his aura, they just turn into flowers. That is transcendent forgiveness. It is forgiveness beyond forgiveness. It's the point at which there's nothing in you that can be offended, because you're not clinging to anything. Offence, taking offence, feeling resentment, feeling hurt, is to do with defending that ego identity, to trying to hold on to it and to punish or to threaten, to deal with what has transgressed it. So forgiveness strikes very, very deep in Dhamma life, and I think that it's a practice in its own right. It's a practice that ultimately is an insight practice, but it's an insight practice in the context of bodhicitta, of the bodhisattva life. The bodhisattva forgives all. The bodhisattva cannot be harmed. Whatever harm comes to the bodhisattva transforms into value for the other. So when I say that I think in our 50th anniversary we need to forgive as the most fundamental of our responses, of course, different people will have different relations to the things I'm going to say, but all of us need to forgive so much from the past. And within the movement, without the movement, but especially within the spiritual community. Without forgiveness, no spiritual community. And in doing that, we're helping to build Sangha, but we're also fulfilling our commitment to the Three Jewels, our going for refuge to the Three Jewels. So, yes, I think that's a very, very pertinent reflection for a day like this, especially while we're having another bout of introspection about our past. We need to view it in that light. Of course, it's not just that you forgive and forget. I remember Bhante saying that, in fact, that he forgave but he did not forget. What I understand by that is that you let go of the egoistic reaction, but you learn from what happened. You look into what happened, and you learn from it, and you try to make sure it doesn't happen again. So again, topically, we now know that Kalyanamitrata and sex is a potentially toxic brew. We know that. It might seem strange, it seems obvious now, but in the 1960s, it certainly didn't. But we've learnt that. So we need to both forgive and to understand. We need to see what's happened to learn the lessons from it in the light of the Dhamma. It's not just a question of forgiving our past, our last 50 years, although it certainly is that. Maybe especially for those of you who didn't participate in that past, you have to forgive us lot. You have to, sorry, that's not quite the right word, but we ask you to forgive us. And I hope you do, because I think if you can't forgive us, you can't benefit from what little we did achieve, or what we did achieve. Let's not belittle it. If you can't forgive us, well, your experience of what we did in helping to set up this movement will be obscured by your sense of, the damage, as it were. So without forgetting the damage, without ignoring it, without pretending it didn't happen, you forgive and you learn the lesson and you try to build that then into the life of the community. Although I think in the early years of the movement, it was pretty chaotic. Wonderfully chaotic, as well as awfully chaotic. It's hard to explain to those who did not live through the 60s and to some extent the 70s just what they were like. For somebody of my generation, I was born in 1947, and I sort of came of age with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and LSD and all that. We discovered it. Timothy Leary and... anyway, stop. And Pink Floyd, the real Pink Floyd, before Syd Barrett left them, etc. Jimi Hendrix. Ah, stop. I met Jimi Hendrix in New York. Anyway, I won't boast. Incredibly creative period, and also extremely chaotic and destructive. I had many friends who damaged themselves seriously with drugs. I saw many people who got sexually transmitted diseases or just got themselves completely burned out because they lost all boundaries in sex. But it was a time of enormous experimentation, exploration. We'd kicked out our poor old parents who'd won the war, and without any gratitude, we just kicked them out and grew our hair long, even though they didn't like it, or got our skirts short, even though they certainly didn't like it. The longer our hair got, the shorter our friend's skirts got. Really quite brutal. I really feel sorry for the way in which I treated my own parents, who were very good parents. But, it's this sudden change in culture and attitude and atmosphere. We just threw it all out. And the movement came out of that. Much that's really good came out of that. But we also really did a lot that was harmful to ourselves and to each other. And that you, dear friends, have inherited some of the outcome from. Sangharakshana himself was, of course, 42 when the movement was founded, but he himself was exploring. For a start, he was gay in London, at a time when it was completely illegal and seriously penalised. He was a monk in India for 20 years, so he's sort of discovering a side of himself that hadn't been possible for him to do before in this atmosphere that anything goes. And, there's much that was creative about that, but there's also much that has left its traces in the movement. So we do ask for your understanding, us who were there and caused some of your problems. We do ask for your understanding. We ask for your forgiveness that in our struggle to create a new movement, with nothing, there was hardly any Buddhism in 1967. I was dimly aware of three or four other groups. Began to come in very fast after that. But now, you've got so many different Buddhist groups around. There was almost nothing at that time. And what was so appealing about Sangharakshana and the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order was that he seemed to completely embrace this new culture. He wasn't afraid of it. He welcomed it. He'd tried LSD himself, pretty clearly not recommending it, if you see what I mean, but he tried it. He listened to Bob Dylan. He didn't think much of him. I've got to forgive him that as well. But he embraced our world and connected with us in a way that was completely exceptional for grey straights. You know what that means. Somebody over 30. Probably 25, actually, who just was part of straight society. We used to make that distinction. Straight then mean not hip, not the drug culture, as it were. So Bhante sort of embraced it. He enabled us to connect with him. He let us in fully, and he sort of talked our language without ever compromising with it. We were really confused, chaotic, at this particular juncture of Western culture. I think something similar is beginning to happen in India. This radical breakdown in relations between the generations. I had nothing in common with my parents. Where I've noticed my friends occupy the same culture as their own children. They listen to the same music and so forth. The children have got good taste, they go back to the oldies. But we had this absolute radical break, which was tremendously freeing, but meant that our maturation was a little odd, if you see what I mean. If you've got a healthy culture, you mature within that healthy culture, which has ways of sort of taking you on to the next level in a healthy way. That wasn't there. We kicked it out. We destroyed it. We did the exact opposite. And the movement started in all of that. So things that maybe, you know, started off with some helpful edge to them got sort of blown out of proportion. And it took some time for that to be purged. So, we need you to forgive us and to then I think you need to realise you're going to do it too. You won't do it in the same ways, but a spiritual community, a Dhamma community, is inevitably a junction between ordinary human beings with quite a high degree of self-unconsciousness, not really knowing ourselves, quite a lot of habits from the past, quite a lot of blind spots, of course, for many of us, complex psychological issues to be dealt with. At the same time, we're in relation to high ideal, the highest ideal there can be. I speak as a Buddhist. An ideal that isn't just a sort of formula, a set of words, an ideal that is some sort of living, felt reality. The Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. The Buddha is not just a sort of historical guy who lived 2,500 years ago, but if you connect with the Buddha, as I've been saying in my recent rambles, you're connecting with a consciousness, a quality of consciousness that is transcendent. You're connecting with the Dhamma not as a formulation of teaching, but as a deep felt reality that is, in a sense, alive. I'm speaking metaphorically, but only just metaphorically. It's better to think of it as alive than as dead. You're connecting with a sangha, which is not the literal sangha of, you know, our movement or whatever. It's an ideal sangha. There's the perfect human community of all those who've realized the Dhamma through the Buddha. So you're connecting with that and having a real felt connection with that. That's what I found when I immediately connected with the Dhamma, that it was something alive for me. It was almost visible. It was visible at times in a visionary sense, something tangible, something I felt in my bones. So you're in contact with that, and you're also an unregenerate, rather immature, 21-year-old, in my case. I can't speak for you. And you're trying to bring the one into relation with the other so that you're transformed and you're more or less successful. Sometimes you mistake for the Dhamma what is not the Dhamma. Sometimes you impose your own personality upon the Dhamma. And sometimes it's just complicated because each of us is a separate and different human being with our own complex psychologies and life experiences, conditionings, and so forth, and it gets really complicated. It will not stop being complicated, brothers and sisters. The business of having a sangha is not one that it can avoid all harm to each other. It's I think, inevitable. I hope you won't make the same mistakes that we made. I hope you will learn from our mistakes. And I hope that you will forgive us. And then I hope when you make your own mistakes or people make mistakes for you, you will forgive them and they will forgive you. So I think we need to take that on board, that part of what being a sangha is this struggle to transcend our narrow personalities and our self-clinging and the harm that inevitably does. Ego-clinging inevitably means coming up against somebody else's ego clinging. And that inevitably produces pain at some point. So our sangha has to grow through facing that creatively. And one of the most important things we have to do is forgive. So, yes, at this 50th anniversary, let's just start there. We could have started in another of... I'm going to tell you three things that I think we need to concentrate on, but I think let's start with that in the circumstances. It's a bit topical, Let's start with forgiveness. If we can't forgive, then we will not be able to do what is then necessary, which is feel gratitude. Without forgiveness, there cannot be gratitude. Let's take Bhante, for instance. As I say, I've never had anything to forgive him for. Personally, and nothing he's done has harmed me, whether directly or indirectly. I think I've probably harmed him. I think I've reacted to him. Anyway, I won't detail. I won't give you a catalogue. But if I feel resentment towards him, if I feel unhappy with him in some way, I cannot then feel gratitude to him, and I cannot benefit from what he has given me. So forgiveness, I think, is an inevitable accompanier of gratitude. You may, if you can just feel gratitude without anything to forgive, so much the better. Somebody else will need your forgiveness. But if you can feel gratitude, you can only feel gratitude if you're able to forgive. If you can't feel gratitude, you cannot benefit. This is pretty obvious when you think about it. When you see that something has benefited you, you feel gratitude for it, and the benefit that it's done you is sort of valued, if you see what I mean. If you can't feel gratitude, you don't value what you've gained. If you don't value what you've gained, it doesn't work for you. So, for instance, for me at least, Sangha I got from Bhante, and then from everybody else who got it from him. Sangha has been probably the principal practice of my life through practicing Sangha, which is not always an easy one. Through practicing friendship with others, through sticking with others, even when I don't like them and they're awkward and difficult and transgress against me, sticking with them, I've grown to the extent that I have. So I'm deeply grateful to Sangharakshita for the notion of Sangha that he's brought alive, which is quite different from that which is generally understood, and for the form that he's given that. So if I can't feel grateful for him, to him, for bringing that about, I can't really fully appreciate what it is, and therefore I can't fully benefit from it. It won't fully work for me. So gratitude is considered in Buddhism one of the most important virtues to cultivate, because gratitude leads to or is connected with a real perception of value. If you perceive value, you feel gratitude for whatever has brought that value to you, whatever has enabled you to experience that value. So it's very simple. We need to feel gratitude. Gratitude to, I think it's unavoidable, to Sangharakshita, to Bhante. Even if we feel we must forgive him for whatever it is that we feel he's done that has harmed us or harmed others. We need to forgive him. Then we can appreciate what he's given us and feel gratitude for it. What he's given us is really quite extraordinary. And I'm sort of obliged on a day like this just to remind us of what it is. I was thinking about where to start, and I remembered that in 1950, just after he'd received his Shramaniya ordination, his Indian teacher, Jagdish Kashyapji, Bhikshu Jagdish Kashyap, took him on tour, the holy places, a number of other places, and then up into the Himalayas to Kalimpong. And after they'd been there for a little while in a Buddhist vihara there, he just told him, I'm going back to the plains, I'm going to go into the jungle to meditate and see what my next move is in life, and I want you to stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. the way Bante always quotes it is he just said, stay here and work for the good of Buddhism. And Sangharakshita had made a sort of vow that he would just do whatever Kashyapji asked him to do. So it was very difficult because Kashyapji was a very unassuming man and always asked him what he should do, if you see what I mean. But so he took very, very seriously this injunction from his preceptor to stay in Kalimpong and work for the good of Buddhism. And reading his memoirs, it's very clear that's just been the guiding principle of his life. He didn't stay there in the end, but he stayed here, as it were, and worked for the good of Buddhism as best he could, given the material that was around him. And if you read those early memoirs, he had some pretty strange companions and worked pretty well with them, at least by his own account. We'll have to listen to that someday. He seems from that point on to have completely dedicated his life to the good of Buddhism. And one thing I've really noticed with Bante, and he's told me this quite explicitly, that he's never planned what he's going to do. He's never sort of set out with, I know what, in 1967 I'm going to go to England, I'm going to start in a small basement a new Buddhist movement called the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, and it will one day be change its name, it'll have a London Buddhist Centre and a West London Buddhist Centre and so forth. He didn't think like that at all. It's as if he's connected to the Dhamma, and connected to the Dhamma, for my purposes, very deeply indeed, and simply allows that to express itself appropriately within whatever circumstance he finds himself. So he works with what's in front of him and allows the Dhamma to work through him. I mean, as he's pointed out recently, of course, he's also got a personality which to some extent means that it's going to take this form, not that form. For instance, he's never been much interested in science. His interests are mainly literary and cultural. So that's quite strongly affected the movement, and he suggested maybe we need to sort of round that out at some time. Maybe there are also features of his personality that in themselves are quite innocent, but play out in a certain way. He's always, if you meet him, he's always sort of slightly outside the situation, which doesn't mean that he's not completely present, but he's very, very reflective. So if you ask him something, you won't necessarily get an answer immediately, or you often won't get an answer immediately, but you'll hear the answer 3 or 4 weeks later from somebody else who's told him about it. So not so easy for one such as me, at least, always to get into an immediate dialogue with him. I think it's innocent. I think it's just a question of character. We all come with a character. Mine is as plain as anything to everybody. And you can't help it. It's all right. It's completely innocent. You're this shape, not that shape, if you see what I mean. And half the task of Dhamma life is to use that in a way that's constructive and not destructive. But it takes quite a lot of skill. I think I'm just beginning to realise what I'm like. Everybody else realised a long time ago, but I'm just beginning to work it out. Anyway, I won't go into that. I'm endlessly fascinated as I am. Yes, he had to sort of... He works with the situation, it being himself, but deeply inspired by the Dhamma. I believe by bodhicitta, I think that's the best way to put it, by the mind of the Buddha as an active force. But it has to work through him, sometimes even, as it were, slightly against him. But he's sort of let it unfold, and what he has unfolded, at least for many of us, for most of us here, I imagine, is extraordinarily appropriate, extraordinarily approachable. It has its defects and problems, but it's amazing how clear and effective it is. Principles. Bante's always been very, very clear about principles. So he's always put principles, so to speak, before strategies. which I've learnt a huge amount from, being a man who wants to drop out of the sky and start shooting. I've learnt to stand back and look for a little while before you open up. So we owe, what I'm trying to get at is, we owe to this man a huge debt, that he had the courage, the confidence, the inspiration, the vision to start such an extraordinarily clear and open version of the Sangha, which relates to the deepest principles of the Dhamma. Very interesting, I've just written the foreword for A Survey of Buddhism, which was his first major piece of writing. And what I realized in writing that is that in A Survey of Buddhism, which was published in 1957, so 10 years before the movement was started, he'd sort of laid out the essential principles upon which the movement is founded. Not some of that had more working out to do, some things he's modified his views on, but he's sort of thought deeply about the nature of the Dhamma, felt deeply the nature of the Dhamma, experienced deeply the nature of the Dhamma, and then lived that out in community with others who he's brought in to share it with him. So, what I'm really getting at, and I need to cut myself short a bit, is that we owe him an incalculable debt of gratitude, which we can only pay if we forgive. But actually, we owe quite a lot of debt gratitude to a lot of other people. I was thinking that there are quite a lot of people who have gone and you may never know about, for instance. Just coming in here, you know, I remember the building project that we had here in 18, I can't remember, a long time ago. And for instance, you know, you got these hangings here, which were made by Dhammacharini Anjali, who died just a couple of years ago. This plinth on which the Buddha sits was made by Dhammachari Alia, who died a couple of years ago. A lot of the plastering work and the plasterboarding and so forth was done by Dhammachari Punya, who's gone, went 10 years ago or more. So there are lots and lots of people who've contributed who we don't know about, and you may never know about. Lots and lots of people. Some people have left the order, but gave so much to it. Like a lot of the design for the first design was done by ex-Dhammachari Devaraja. So on and so on. It could go on and on. So many people have contributed to what Tri Ratna is today. My own generation did a lot, and a lot of us kept on doing it. You have our mistakes also to deal with, but we did our best in the circumstances, and I shouldn't have to say this, but you're fortunate to inherit that. So there's, over the years, so many people inspired first by Sangha Rakshita have created this extraordinary Sangha, which is now all over the world, all the time. I don't know, I think they're over there, my brothers and sisters in India, who have such deep gratitude for what they got. I'm going to read you a WhatsApp message. That's the main medium of communication with India. I've forgotten how to... Oh, yes, that's right. This is from... You can see why the new generation has to take over. This is from a Dhamma Mitra from North India, who's had a very, very, very painful and difficult life, partly to do with caste, partly to do with very bad treatment. Her husband was murdered, and a really horrible life. But she came into the movement about 3 or 4 years ago, and what's outstanding about her is that she's just full of gratitude. Her name is Amla Sheel. But she writes, "Hello, I wish you a very happy 50th anniversary of TBMS. In those 50 years, a big revolution has taken place, the revolution which has touched thousands of lives and changed them forever. I've seen people living a beautiful, happy, non-superstitious, this is important in India, rational, again important in India, a peaceful, joyful life in the Sangha. Bhante has given us that which couldn't be given by anyone in this world. He has made the approach of Buddhism in such a practical and modern form that no one in 2,500 years could have done. He has driven the vision of Baba Saheb to us. Without Bhante, we could hardly succeed to understand Baba Saheb. Baba Saheb is Dr. Ambedkar, who led the conversion movement in 1956 of millions of people who had formerly untouchable Dalits. And she's from that community. So what people feel in India is that Baba Saheb, Dr. Ambedkar, made the conversion. He took the step into Buddhism, but then people didn't know what to do. They didn't know how to practice. They didn't know how to form Sangha. So this is what Amla Sheel is saying. I feel proud, uplifted, lucky and liberated when I think of Bhante, that I am the part of such a beautiful Sangha. I feel I would not have got such a beautiful life of freedom where I can practice the human virtues of compassion, equality and freedom without Sangha. I would have not learned how to be skillful, how to eradicate unskillful me. I would have not learned how I can be free from all the forms of suffering of life without Sangha. All I can say is I am blessed. Thank you, Bhante. Thank you, my Kalyana Mitras, and all the practitioners who with their efforts made me feel that my life is worthwhile, my life is important. So I've just chosen a single voice, and chosen a voice from India, because Indians have no difficulty with gratitude. We really could learn a lot from them. No difficulty with gratitude, no difficulty with reverence. But I could choose many voices from other places too. I've gathered that this morning we heard some wonderful voices of gratitude. So we need to allow ourselves to feel with the same intensity as my dear friend Amla Sheel does, our gratitude to those who've created the Sangha, which has given us opportunities we could not have had. For myself, I'm pretty sure that I would have made a very big mess of my life if I had not come across the Sangha. I don't know in what way. I can think of several different possibilities, and probably it would have been all of them. But I know that I would have made a horrible mess of myself. I had a deep, deep need for something that only the Dhamma could fulfill, and only the Dhamma in the Sangha could fulfill. So I hope that on this occasion we follow this through in deeper and deeper detail, as it were, remembering all our ancestors, all those who've contributed, all those who've made possible whatever it is that we get from the Sangha, and forgiving them whatever harm they may have done, whether directly or indirectly to us or to others, just experience our deep gratitude to them. So there's one more quality I think we need to reflect on this occasion. I think, in a way, forgiveness and gratitude are about enough, aren't they? If we could really feel those, everything else would follow. But when we look back, we see how much has been done. It's quite incredible when I think about what I encountered when I went down into that basement. Just a few hippies and a guy in slightly grubby robes with great big mutton chop whiskers and many rings on his fingers. It's something sort of dangerous about him because he just could not be categorized. That's what it was. I just walked into that. I'd no idea what it meant. I remember the first meditation I had, I hit dhyana, which took me years to hit again. We question and answer session afterwards where this man just so easily and naturally and openly just made the Dhamma plain in a context of deep appreciation of Western culture. But that's what it was. You could not have imagined what we have today 50 years ago, or at least 48 years ago. And Bhante himself says he finds it incredible what has happened, and he says that he knows that he didn't do it, not just in the sense that others contributed to it, but that it was something, as it were, greater working in and through him to create it, the Dhamma, a living Dhamma, the bodhicitta, a living bodhicitta working through him, now working amongst us. So, yes, it was incredible. But, dear brothers and sisters, we've not finished. We definitely haven't finished. I'm almost finished. The race is now downhill for me. I'll be lucky if, well, I might be unlucky if I'm around in 20 years, which I view with complete equanimity, I should say. Maybe I'll be around in 120 years, but I probably won't remember anything if that's the case. But yes, it's not really in my hands. I feel that my day is done, and that just as I and my friends, Deva Mitra and others, laid the foundations on the basis of Bhante's inspiration, it's now for all of you, particularly the younger amongst you, to lay the foundations for the next stage. It's going to be different. I probably won't like it. but I probably will tell you that when I come to your creche. It's going to be different. It's a very different world to the world that I, that the movement came out of. So much has changed. But I believe that actually it's more crucial than it's ever been before. Subhadramati mentioned my saying, I can't remember what it was, what wonderful quotation. I wish I could remember it. What was it? How do you build a nation? Something like that. What I meant was that if we are to change this world, we have to implant in this world a completely new vision. Societies are not governed by law. Law helps. They're not governed by methods of selecting a government. They're not governed even by governments. That's pretty obvious. What drives society is their underlying values, their underlying perspective on life, their understanding of the meaning of human existence, their understanding of what is right and what is wrong. And this great insight comes initially from Dr. Ambedkar, and Bhante's picked it up very strongly, that the duty, our duty for the future, is duty too dirty a word? Anyway, it just translate. I'm now going back before my 1960s inheritance, my naval officer father. But duty, I don't think, is a dirty word. I think what it means is your recognition of what needs to be done. And once you know what needs to be done, if you're at all honourable and integrated, you must do it. So it's that feeling, that's what needs to be done. I can see it. I must help to do it. So our duty is to create a deeper vision for the whole of society, a deeper ethical vision for the whole of society. And my goodness, does it need it? We're vividly aware of that at the moment, with this strong reaction against the liberal consensus, which perhaps probably had to happen. It's been waiting to happen. Liberalism is not enough. There needs to be a much deeper basis for a good society. And that the only basis, I think, is in deep moral and spiritual principles, which I believe, as a Buddhist, are best expressed and most clearly and unequivocally and unambiguously expressed in the Buddha Dhamma. So your job, brothers and sisters, I shall watch you from whatever realm I go to. Actually, I'll come back. I'll be here. Don't worry. Your job, your duty, is to try to implant this new vision of human life and human society on the basis of the Dhamma into the whole political, social, collective, cultural sphere. We need to make it live in that context, not just as a little corner for alternatives who generally vote left, as it were. It must be much more central, much more essential, and go way beyond party divisions and ideological perspectives. It's something much, much deeper. And I think the next phase of human history is pretty make or break. Every generation thinks this, but it looks to me like it's make or break. I mean, right now, we've got the Americans firing Tomahawk missiles into an ally of the Russians. It's never been this dangerous. In my time, of course, America and Russia had, or Britain too, had mutually assured destruction. But we've not had such a close shooting war in my memory. I suppose the nearest was American backing of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. But it is much, much closer. There are actually Russians there. It's getting ratcheted up all the time, and the capacity of technology to amplify destructive power is getting more and more great. But I'm not without hope. I'm not without hope because of the Dhamma, and also just some sort of strange human resilience. But I think our duty for the next 50 years is to live the Dhamma very vividly ourselves, to go for refuge very deeply ourselves, to create together a more and more effective Sangha on the basis of what's already come, to build that far more effectively, far stronger, far more mature, far more multi-layered and multivalent all over the world, and to then transmit that in direct ways by bringing people into centres and teaching them to meditate, teaching them Dhamma, and indirect ways by influencing the world, even through politics, through cultural media, through journalism, in every way we possibly can, to implant this deep, deep vision of what it is to be a human being and what a human society could be. So I'd like to suggest that this is what our dedication needs to be for the next 50 years, this aspiration to make the Buddha Dhamma close to the heart of the world, so that the world's heart beats to the rhythm of the Dhamma, the drum of the Dhamma. And this is what we need to reflect on this occasion. Forgive what has happened before that has been unskillful or harmful. Feel gratitude to those who've made it possible, beginning with Bhante, and always he must be there. Feeling that gratitude very deeply, then we can appreciate. Once we've forgiven, we can feel grateful. When we feel grateful, we can really appreciate. And when we can feel grateful and appreciate, then we can work to put that at the heart of our world that needs it as never before. So, that's your job for the next 50 years, and at the 100th anniversary, one of you will stand here and remember the last 50 years and a plead for forgiveness too, you'll have to, appeal for gratitude and appeal for an even stronger effort to put the Dhamma at the heart of the world. Thank you very much.